Welcome to Chronic Combat Conversations, a live look at our best bets, picks, and predictions for this weekend's UFC card, Rozenstruik versus Gone. With your hosts, TB Scouting MMA and...
the MMA Guru. And we've got an exciting heavyweight clash between Jairzinho, Rozenstruik, and Ciryl Gane. It could be a title contender shaper. I mean, this is a real important fight for the landscape of the heavyweight division, one that really had to happen, and one that I'm honestly really excited about here on UFC Vegas 20, UFC Fight Night 186, UFC on ESPN Plus 44, whatever you call it. We got a heavyweight fight going down, hopefully COVID and weight cuts, you know, notwithstanding.
As we learned our lesson last week, let's see how those, those weigh-ins go, the face-offs. Here we are back on the horse. It wasn't, the worst week by any stretch.
Oh, it was a terrible week for me.
Were a lot of positions that we might have, acted differently on had we fully waited to place the bets until after the weigh-ins.
100%. Weigh-ins were crazy. When you see the discrepancies between people, like somebody like Jared Gordon, who misses weight by like 4 pounds or whatever and ends up, it's a benefit for him. He looks great. And then Caitlin Vieira misses weight by 2 pounds, but she looks terrible. She looks mentally fatigued. She looked drained and she completely showed in her performance. So it's really, really interesting. And it shows how important weigh-in day is and how much more important it is than the early line movement.
Sometimes you could find the best play, the best value, but if it doesn't end up cashing, then it doesn't really matter much. And if you have to hedge out because of something you saw, the weigh-ins are integral. It's unlike any other sport. We talked about it last week and we went against our own rules. So let's take that as a lesson and move right on forward to this week. And we're starting off with a pretty big matchup in the light heavyweight division. We have a Dana White Contender Series graduate going up against someone who has a vast experience in MMA and Maxim Grishin. Dustin Jacoby coming in against Maxim Grishin. You're looking at, a 4-year age difference. Jacoby, the younger man at 32, he's going to be carrying a 1-inch height advantage, 6'4", to Maxim Grishin at 6'3". But he will be giving up a couple inches of reach. His 76-inch to Grishin's 78. Where Jacoby's advantage will be is in the leg reach at 45 inches to Grishin's 43.5. And I think kicks are going to be playing a big factor in this fight. So it's very interesting to pay attention to the experience that Grishin comes in with, having fought plenty of big hitters in his career, only suffering 2 knockout losses against the guy with 8 knockout wins versus 1 submission and 3 decisions. So I think it's going to take a little bit more than just a couple combinations and flurries to get Grishin out of there.
Yeah, I think you're kind of touching on where I'm, if I was considering placing a bet for this fight, where I would consider placing it. This is lower level MMA at the end of the day. It's 2 light heavyweights. So obviously when these big guys strap on their gloves, when they strap on the leather, I mean, really anything can happen. With that being said, I don't really see either of these guys as huge finishers and in reverse, like somebody like with bad chins. Like I think that, somebody like Maxim Grishin, like I think his chin will hold up against the early onslaught from Dustin Jacoby. And at the end of the day, like I'm concerned about Jacoby's cardio. Can he keep that cardio up? So for me, it's not really a fight that I'm looking to bet sidewise. I guess if I'm going to play anything, I might just play the fight to go the distance at +108.
There's a lot of value on that. Grishin, like we said, is proven to be durable, and he has 4 submission losses, but I don't know that that's going to be a threat against Jacoby here, who just seems to be a much lower level grappler. His takedowns that he landed on Contender Series were really only because he had his opponent rocked. Flores really might have not been on the same level as him. And a lot of times you see in Contender Series fights that they kind of set one guy up to look a lot better. He completely gassed out going for the finish in round two. And, you know, he shows high level combinations. He snaps off all kicks at all levels with ease. You know, they come off well. That kickboxing background definitely is apparent. You know, he took a long time off from MMA to fight in Glory and, you know, eventually worked his way back, training out of Factory X. You know, he is a switch stance, so that's always an interesting thing to bring to the table.
Definitely. I mean, from what I saw from Jacoby, I mean, he does frame really well and he uses his reach really, really well. He has his strong punches, but, you know, he's got that wide side facing stance. What I saw for, again, from Grishin being able to hang in there with Tybura up a weight class and then to go out there and finish Antigulov like you need to close out Antigulov's UFC career. I think that's what I personally needed to see from Grishin to see that he at least belongs on in the fringe of this UFC light heavyweight division. But again, Jacoby for me, beating Justin Ledet doesn't really show me much of anything, and he was getting hit a couple times in that first round. I mean, don't get me wrong, Ledet was never in control and Jacoby was never really in danger, but you know, he certainly took a couple punches, and I do expect Grishin to have a much better showing and to continue to build off of his Antigulov performance. So if you're seeing where I might be leaning, I'm definitely waiting for Wade.
Yeah, I want to see how they look facing off. I think Grishin is going to have a big advantage in the grappling in a small cage, and he's a veteran. I mean, he knows how to check kicks, and he knows how to dish out some kicks of his own. The things that were most interesting as far as the line, Maxim Grishin at +145, I find that very appealing. And Maxim Grishin by submission, with 6 submissions in his career and having fought some of the best grapplers, you know, Marcin Tybura at heavyweight, and he survived to a decision. And he fought a 5-round fight against Magomed Ankalaev and lost by a round 4 knockout. But I don't think you can really blame him too badly for that one, given how he survived the first 3 rounds and really, you know, put on a decent fight. So let's move along. Go into Vince Cachero versus Ronnie Lawrence. And we have Ronnie Lawrence coming in from Dana White Contender Series as well versus Vince Cachero, who has a background with LFA. And, you know, we see these guys, you know, size up pretty well. Ronnie Lawrence, a 2-inch height advantage, where Cachero does match him in the reach at 68 inches. Ronnie Lawrence is 3 years younger. One of the things about him is his gas tank and his ability to continually go for takedowns. He's got the BJJ brown belt and recently started training at Sanford MMA. So that's a big development.
Great, Jim.
We see Cachero at Factory X, so that's no slight on him either. And he's been in there against some great opponents, Jamal Emmers and Casey Kenney. You know, he did lose by a round 1 knockout to Casey Kenney, you know, back in 2019. So it's not too long ago. And Ronnie Lawrence coming in here looking relatively inexperienced, but he does have a 6-0 amateur record and does seem to really know what he's doing as far as flow on the mat.
He's certainly somebody that feels comfortable. Looks like he's certainly born to, you know, be a fighter. And he's got good footwork. He kicks from the outside. Good takedowns. Kind of almost spammed the takedown in his Dana White Contender Series fight.
Yeah, and
fight,
it was against a guy who had a vast boxing experience. So he definitely left himself open for a lot.
So fight IQ,
yeah,
in that respect, right?
I agree.
So that's all positives. I mean, his one loss in his career is to Steve Garcia, who's made his way to the UFC. I mean, he had a loss to Luis Pena, but, you know, you like to see when a guy's losses are to UFC caliber opponents, which is what you've seen in Vince Cachero. But that being said, I'm not backing a guy that's lost 3 out of his last 4. That's not happening to me, for me. You know, I just know. I mean, listen, he took that Jamal Emmers fight on short notice and, you know, up a weight class. So that's it. I mean, that shows the size of his balls. I mean, Cleveland size, like massive, awesome. Like, I mean, he gets all the props and respect, but I don't know that he's going to come out here and bounce back into the win column versus Ronnie Lawrence when he's shown suspect takedown defense.
Yeah, and not just against Jamal Emmers, but, you know, even back in LFA before that, he really seemed to get taken down at ease. I believe I was watching him against Nolene Hernandez, and, you know, or actually even better, against another opponent very recently, I believe one of his last wins. And, you know, he just he overwhelmed this guy who came in on extremely short notice. And, you know, he got taken down in like the first 15, 20 seconds by this guy who really had no business even having a chance. And he just completely gasses out after 2 minutes, and Cachero's able to turn the tide and get a knockout. But, you know, that's the win that gets him, you know, to where he needs to go. I'm not too impressed.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I'm leaning Lawrence. I think I like Lawrence by decision plus 125. Listen, that being said, waiting for weigh-ins. This guy's, it's his UFC debut on short notice. I mean, bright lights. He could miss weight. He could just freeze up out there. You know, I got to see how he looks. I got to look, you know, I got to look him in the eye like Vince Cachera does and really see what this guy's made of. Because if I see something I don't like, I'd be very happy to hop off.
I see Ronnie Lawrence submission plus 700. He's going to be able to get him in some bad positions on the mat, and that brown belt might come in handy. So I think if you're looking for a long odds play, you know, I know I already told you about a couple submissions on the first two fights, but at those odds, given the background and grappling that they have in the small cage, might be worth a little play. But if not, I do think I will be taking a look at Lawrence at minus 167 on the money line, maybe to add into a two-leg parlay. So unfortunately, we did have a cancellation already, COVID cancellation. Alonzo Menifield, hope you get better soon, and I hope that your symptoms aren't too bad. Unfortunately, we were looking to be on a side here pretty hard, so it's nice to see it get rebooked going forward. On to the next fight that's actually scheduled for this weekend. We have Alexis Davis versus Sabina Mazo. And could this be a possible bet lesson?
I don't know. I mean, listen, it definitely could be. I think Alexis Davis has the clinching and the you know, the wrestling background, but at the end of the day, she hasn't shown it in so long. I mean, she's her best quality that she's shown over her last five fights would be her durability. Durable against Arujo, durable against Maya, you know, hanging in there versus these, you know, tough chicks that they keep throwing her. I think that Mazo, listen, all the numbers are on Mazo's side. She's a young fighter, up and comer, really exciting, has dominated, has looked really good. But that being said, with the numbers as it is, I don't really feel comfortable laying chalk on Mazo. So I won't do it.
The line opened much wider right now. Alexis Davis sitting at plus 170 and Sabina Mazo at minus 215. And I, you know, was originally thinking I might be putting a play on Davis here, but, you know, Mazo, she's faced a lot of opponents that were giving up a lot of height and reach. And in this fight, she's only got a 1-inch height advantage and a 2-inch reach advantage. Not as much as normal, but that leg reach, she still has a 3-inch advantage. And those high kicks that she throws, the right head kick, she could throw it at any point and it could land. And, you know, given Davis's history of cutting up and not looking so great, she does have 3 knockouts on her record, but the last one was in 2014 to Ronda Rousey. You can excuse that. And before that, it came, you know, 2010. You know, so she's, like you said, shown the durability. And, you know, I definitely see a possibility that if she looks great at the weigh-ins and the face-offs, and maybe Mazo shows she's not looking hot, maybe I'll be jumping on the underdog. I'm looking for a reason to bet the underdog, but I just don't know that she'll be able to outpoint her. And the footwork and the movement by Mazo and those clinched knees, and I don't know that Davis is really going to be able to get inside, and that price might not be worth it right now. So I'll see if this prospect is one to really hammer going forward.
Yeah, I mean, Davis hasn't won a fight in 3.5 years. So again, it's really hard to put your money on that. That being said, you know, Mazo is the young technical striker. She kind of looks uncomfortable fighting off of her back foot, kind of uncomfortable fighting off of her back in general. Volume striker, no power. So I don't see a lot of different ways for her to get the job done unless it's by decision. So I think if you're a degenerate and you had to put your money and you really feel strongly either way about a specific fighter, bet one of them to win by decision, because you're going to get good juice on either one of them to win by decision.
That's a very solid idea. So to our next fight, we have a late replacement. Alex Cowboy Oliveira is facing the UFC debutant Ramazan Kurmagomedov. We're talking about Khabib territory. You could see it a little bit in his game. Oliveira, though, vast experience at the UFC level, 17 total fights, and he's definitely shown that he can be submitted. He can lose any which way. He has been knocked out once before, Yancy Medeiros. There are certainly ways that Kurramagomedov could win this fight, but watching his Dana White Contender Series appearance, he just seemed way too hittable.
Yeah, I mean, from what I've seen from Ramazan, he's, relatively unimpressive. He went to absolute war with Williams for the Dana White Contender Series contract, and neither fighter got the contract. Cowboy Oliveira, somebody that's really fought everybody. He missed weight in his last fight. I have no idea where his head's at. He's extremely inconsistent. Somebody that kind of strikes me as relatively unmotivated. You know, he's not really throwing more than 50 or 60 strikes per fight. He doesn't really seem like somebody that wants to be in there anymore. And it really gives me pause on wanting to play him, which I did when you could get him money line at plus money. I don't feel confident that he's somebody that's going to fight for your money and like make you feel good about placing your bet on him. Ramazan at the end of the day is a totally unknown entity that faced like so much salt coming in to the UFC. I mean, he's fought like nobody decent. You probably should pass. Would be my suggestion. Like I said, I think I like Oliveira. Pick wise, I think I would lean Oliveira money line plus 104. But honestly, taking Ramazan in the distance, I haven't seen a line on that yet. But if you can get plus money on him in the distance, I mean, we've seen Oliveira quit in fights before.
I think inside the distance on either side might be a good play on this fight. Oliveira has those crushing attacks to the body. He essentially retired Peter Sabata after he broke his arm. You know, he was ripping kicks to the midsection, and he might be able to keep the distance. I think Kurramagomedov has been hurt many times on the feet, and while he has shown the ability to persevere to get to his grappling points, I think he is going to face a little bit more resistance. And, you know, as far as size goes, Oliveira is going to have a 3.5-inch reach advantage here. You know, he should be able to touch him when he needs to. And I don't think that, you know, Kurramagomedov with one knockout in his record is someone that's really going to be able to hurt Oliveira. Like when he faced Shavkat Rakhmonov, he got hurt to the body. And then the clinch was continued. And then eventually got worked into the guillotine and gave up. I really do think that one of them is going to be able to hit the other, get them hurt. And I just don't think it's worth playing the chalk on the debutante. And it might not be worth even playing Oliveira. You're right. We got to see how he looks at weigh-ins. That could definitely tell us what's going to end up happening. And as I'm scrolling through now, there is no line for it to go the distance or not. So let's keep posted, you know, keep an eye on our Twitters. You know, we'll probably put something out as far as what we're looking at. Let's move right along. Angela Hill versus Ashley Yoder. And this is a rematch, running it back from their matchup on, it was the Ultimate Fighter finale. Is that correct?
I think it was, it was a top 25 finale pay-per-view. I don't think that they were the contestants.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, they're like the filler that they add on.
Not pay-per-view, right. But event.
Ashley Yoder actually carries a pretty sizable reach advantage on Angela Hill. But as we saw in their first matchup, Angela Hill carries a pretty sizable athleticism advantage. And she's able to really catch her when she needs to. She's able to scramble out of bad positions when she needs to. And this is back in 2017 when she's first making her reemergence after the first time she gets cut by the UFC and then comes back. So Angela Hill really showed definitely an improved ability there to work out of some bad positions. And she's faced some of the highest level competition that there is. So you put her in against Ashley Yoder, 8-6. You know, Angela Hill's 12-9 doesn't look so great. But when you see that there's Watterson, Gadelia, Janan, Marcos, Casey, Ansaroff, Andrade, Namajunas, Torres, Esparza, I mean, the list goes on and on. Those are big names that she's losing to.
I mean, that is the who's who of women's MMA in the UFC. And I think what you're getting at, and it's pretty much undeniable at this point, the level of competition that Hill has faced compared to Yoder, despite the somewhat salty record on Angela Hill's part, it's all completely warranted. I mean, Hill has fought so much of a higher level of competition. It's not even close. It's really not up for debate. I think it's safe to say that Yoder's chance to victory is clinching takedowns and riding it out on the ground. And I mean, realistically, getting a submission while would be probably what she's dreaming about and what she's hoping to work for. I mean, that's probably the only place it's happening is in her dreams. I mean, the best chance for Yoder is probably the decision win. That being said, I think Hill, with no real power, but a lot of volume, is somebody that will, again, also win by decision. That's why betting this fight to go to decision is so chalky. I like Hill here. I don't think it's worth anything money line.
You know, it's tough.
Yeah, I don't think it's worth it. I don't think it's really worth much there. I mean, you have to cash at 90%, which, yeah, I do think that Hill, if this fight were to happen 10 times, I do think Hill would win 8 or 9 times. But that being said, it's not really where you want to put your bet. So, I mean, you can get Hill to win by decision at -160 or something. I just stay away from this fight. I, you know, I respect to these ladies. This is a smoke break fight. This is a just kind of kickback study for the next fight for their each one's next opponent. Because there's no real money here. I mean, if you take the value shot on Yoder, I don't hate it. It's just not what I'm gonna be.
Yeah, I'm sure if you wanted to, you could put together a little parlay. You know, I might do something like Lawrence and Angela Hill, because I'm a degenerate and want to have a little bit of something on every fight. So we'll see how that plays out. But let's see how they look at weigh-ins. That's always what we say here. So next fight, we have Alexander Hernandez versus Thiago Moises. And this is a pretty good matchup of some up-and-comers where, you know, they have faced some big names in their careers. They have some wins and losses against big names. And they've actually fought, you know, similar competition in Beneil Dariush. So we have seen, you know, some comparisons to be made. Also, Jamal Emmers, they both fought at much different stages. So, you know, it's very interesting to see who's going to come away with the win and possibly continue their ascension to the top. I don't necessarily see either guy, you know, long-term competing for the belt or anything. But I do think that they can make a little noise in the top 15, if, you know, possibly. So, you know,
both guys are really exciting prospects in terms of where they are in their UFC career, what they've shown in terms of their potential and the lumps that they've kind of already taken throughout their UFC career. This is, I don't want to say a crossroads fight for both guys, but I'd say critical or pivotal. I think this is an important matchup for both guys, as the winner of this fight is going to get, I would say, a sizable step up in competition, whereas the guy that loses will either get lateral. I don't even think they'll get a lateral level. I think that they'll get a drop down in level of competition.
I think as we look at their, you know, how they size up, they should be about the same height. You know, Hernandez is going to have an inch and a half of reach advantage, and he should be the more athletic fighter, at least to start out the fight. And, you know, maybe with his move to Factory X recently and training in elevation, some of his cardio woes, you know, like we looked at last card, I did end up playing Imavov and Hawes to go to the decision. And sometimes if guys show to have made some kind of change in their routine or something, you have to take notice. So they have juiced the go to decision, because that's where I think this fight's going. It's at -140 right now. Moises has never been knocked out in his career, whereas Hernandez has 5 knockout wins and 5 decision wins. Moises' 2 losses in the UFC have come by decision. So we could see a scenario where Hernandez outpoints him in the first round, and he most likely will. He's going to come out aggressive and come out with, you know, a high-impact plan. But he's heavy on the lead leg, and I think it's possible that Moises will, you know, include some leg kicks. He's shown to have some very powerful head kicks, and he showed, you know, some improvements in his last fight against Bobby Green, where, you know, he might not be the, you know, the next big thing as a stand-up guy, but his bread and butter is to get to his grappling. So the question is, does Hernandez keep up the footwork and the cardio and avoid being taken down and grappled out? because he's definitely live to be submitted. You know, we're talking a black belt, been training since 8 years old, versus a brown belt who does have a vast wrestling record, but it's not like Moises doesn't have any wrestling in his game. He has shown the ability to get in on a guy like Bobby Green and get him to the ground, who has proven to have good takedown defense. So I'm interested to know what you think, and if you see any specific lines here that caught your eye.
The specific line that caught my mind is Hernandez by decision plus 135. I don't necessarily see the fight the way that you see it. Yeah, I think he's really bought into his time over at Factory X. You've seen him corner fights for fighters at Factory X. You're seeing him on Instagram running at elevation, running up mountains. You're seeing him talk differently in his interviews. You've seen him fight a much higher level of competition than Thiago Moises, who, by the way, did not win that fight over Bobby Green. I'm sorry. You can, you know, come at me in the DMs, you know, with your pitchfork, whatever. It's fine. Bobby Green won rounds one and two. And while he looked like, I mean, his face was completely busted up after round three, you know, that happens just because you look bad. I mean, unless it's a 10-8 and you want to call it a draw, it's a point. Like, you can't just give a fighter the fight because you feel like it. You know, because he looks worse in a street fight. You know, it's just not the way the UFC is. It's just not the way that the point system works. So, no, I don't think that Moises won that fight. And people, you know, saying that, oh, wow, he looked really good, much better versus Bobby Green. Well, like, yeah, you know, as he looked versus Michael Johnson, he looked as bad as you could possibly look. And then Michael Johnson snatches defeat out of the jaws of victory, pure Michael Johnson-esque. And he just completely, you know, gives up the ankle lock in 25 seconds into round two. I mean, to me, Moises has not shown enough. And while, yeah, I mean, sure, he's a live dog and we've seen underdogs, you know, do decently well. Hernandez is worse when he's has to fight moving backwards and he's being pressured. And Moises is not that guy. You watched it versus Bobby Green. He still walks backwards. He still shells up. You saw it in the first round of Michael Johnson. He shells up. You saw it versus Dariush. When he gets pressured, Moises, he doesn't do very well. So while Hernandez is similar in that fact, he doesn't do as well being pressured. Hernandez is going to be the one doing the pressuring here because that's going to be his game plan. And he knows that he's going to want to stay off of his back because that's where Moises' best chance to victory is. So I think I see this one standing. I think I see Hernandez being a little bit more mature. And I see him, you know, maybe like you're saying, maybe, I think he, you know, wins a 29-28 unanimous decision.
Yeah, I think that if he fights to his full potential, that he should walk away with the win. So, yeah, I am once again going to wait for weigh-ins here. But if I had to pick a side at this moment without looking at the line, yeah, I would probably circle, you know, Alexander Hernandez. But as far as bets go, if they give me any reason to pull the trigger on the underdog in this fight, you know, given the vast experience in martial arts for his opponent, Moises, if he gets caught sleeping at any point or does lose his gas tank, I think I might just play the chalky go to decision here.
Yeah. I mean, listen, if you're somebody that is on the side of questioning or really worried about Hernandez's gas tank, don't bet him in this fight. I personally am on the side of his gas tank is not as bad as it seems or is getting better. So that's why I've feel decently confident on Hernandez. That being said, he comes in tomorrow looking fat, drained, and, you know, weighs in 2.5 pounds overweight. I'll be the first one on the Thiago Moises train with you. And that being said, Thiago Moises goes out there and wins a dominant decision or chokes out Hernandez and towards the end of round two after Hernandez's gas. I mean, again, I will happily hitch my wagon to you driving the Moises train, but or whoever is driving it, but I'm certainly not on the Moises train yet. That's not where I'm hitching my wagon.
So it sounds like you're pretty firmly on a side. Sounds like I'm still a little up in the air on the side as far as betting goes, but let's move right along. Alex Caceres versus Kevin Kroom. We have a longtime UFC veteran, 22 fights in the UFC for Caceres, and Kroom coming in and technically doesn't have a win on his record due to some just terrible laws out there. Chronic issues. The commission. It's not even USADA at this point. It's the commission. They just want to make money. And Kroom called them out at his interview, and I completely agree with that. It's a way for them to get a little extra cash. But looking as far as the matchup goes, we've seen these Glory MMA guys, James Krause, time and time again recently, just come out and put out a hell of a performance in the UFC, especially in without the crowd, especially being able to hear James Krause in the corner telling them what to do, giving out the best instruction. I mean, he really is on another level as far as being able to connect to what his fighters can do and building a game plan for them.
Yeah, I mean, if James Krause didn't win your Coach of the Year 2020, he's got to be one of your early front runners for Coach of the Year 2021.
I'm sorry, Derek,
right?
Minner by decision? I mean, who the hell was picking that? Yeah, definitely not me. A little egg on the head there. But, you know, Alex Caceres, he's someone that has proven time and time again to be very inconsistent. And you look at his last few matchups, and a lot of these guys really didn't bring much on the feet. And a lot of these names that you see on his resume are not guys that have, you know, a lot of UFC history. When you look at his losses, however, you know, you see Cron Gracie with the round one sub. You see Jason Knight with the round two sub. You see Yair Rodriguez. There's a lot, you know, Uriah Faber. There's a lot more names you recognize. And you see, okay, well, every time he seems to take a step up in competition, doesn't seem to do so hot.
Yeah, I mean, Kroom could very well be the fifth or sixth, the seventh person to now submit Alex Caceres at this point. The one thing that holds true about Alex Caceres is how inconsistent he is. He looked fantastic, like a world beater against Austin Springer in his last fight. That being said, Austin Springer took that fight on short notice. I'm pretty sure he missed weight. He just looked terrible, Austin Springer. I mean, in the fight, in the weigh-ins, he looked terrible. Chase Hooper has absolutely no striking. You'd have to imagine Chase Hooper with any decent amount of striking makes that fight so much more competitive. And that being said, at a certain point, Hooper was able to get to Caceres' back and backpack him. So, you know, you've seen him lose fairly quickly to somebody like Cron Gracie, who we know has no striking, and or I guess maybe a little bit more striking than Chase Hooper, but still really no striking. He's certainly a much more scary, like physically imposing specimen than Chase Hooper. I think Kevin Kroom is a live dog here. It's really hard to fade him. He seems really hungry. I think it's possible he could eat some humble pie if Alex Caceres really comes in, you know, screwed on, straight, ready to rock. But with Kroom at plus 176 and, I don't know, Kroom by decision plus 600, that's just so juicy to me. I don't know if I can pass.
Yeah, you'll see that he's going to apply the pressure in this fight, at least out of the gate. His cardio might not hold up as well, but as we've seen with the game plans and Krause, maybe he manages it a little bit better this time. I'm not willing to completely say I'm going to bet the fight to go the distance in this one specifically, because I think both have, you know, a high potential to finish the fight. You know, Kroom has lost 4 knockouts, 4 submissions, and 4 decisions. So I believe you said it to me earlier in the week. He's not afraid to lose. And that's a great thing as far as his offensive game plan.
Yeah, Kroom is certainly not somebody afraid to lose. And when you see that he has this ability to lose from all separate sides, I mean, would it surprise you if, you know, I told you I looked in the Magic 8 Ball and told you Caceres submitted Kroom? No, I don't think that should surprise you.
You know, I see the hands and the movement and the countering ability of Caceres. You know, he only has won 3 knockouts in his total career, 1 knockout in the UFC over 12 fights. But say Kroom comes in a little bit wild and he's starting to lose his gas a little bit and he doesn't see one of those counters coming from down, because, you know, Caceres keeps his hands a little lower. Not something that I enjoy too much when I'm looking at someone fight. Yeah, they could get the counters off quicker and you don't see him. You know, maybe he could land that knockout here, but I there's just too many different ways this fight could end for me to want to play a go to decision or inside the distance. So if anything, I do see this fight as more of a 50-50 as far as their, you know, just overall abilities. It's not like Kroom hasn't had a lot of fights. He's 21-12. You know, the guy's been in there more than Caceres overall. So as you said, let's take a little look at the dog. If he shows up at weigh-ins looking great again, you know, he's got that little comb going through his hair, getting up in his face, you know, I might be looking to play that.
What I was thinking is that if they both really look good at weigh-ins, then I do think that fight going to decision is actually a really good play. That if they're both in good shape, that neither one of them is going to get the finish and they're both going to come out there and give a good fight. I think that this fight certainly has fight of the night possibilities, fight of the night aspirations, performance bonus aspirations, and certain possibilities here. So, yeah, I am actively watching weigh-ins on this one. I want to see how Caceres looks. I expect him to be a little bit taller, certainly the rangier fighter. I want to see if Kroom looks thicker in any way or if his cut went well with all the crap he was talking. You know, you talk all those that crap in those amber-colored sunglasses. You better come out tomorrow, have a really good weight cut, and, you know, have no problems. Because if you sit there and miss weight and have to give 20% to your opponent, or you just look crappy, like, you can talk all that crap all you want, you can have the funny liner one-liners all you want, you got to come to perform on fight day. And, you know, I don't mean to suggest that he doesn't know that, but he's got to come do it.
And, you know, Caceres sounds really good in his interviews, so
and he's somebody that's been here and done that. Like, he's been on the Ultimate Fighter, he has over 20 UFC fights, while Kroom, like, you know, had a taste of a $50,000 bonus and a big UFC win, big UFC upset. That's far from a up and down UFC career, including a fight against, you know, Uriah Faber. Like, they're just worlds apart in that respect. So I think most of the fight gets done, like, before they even step into the octagon, truly. Like, I think the fight a lot of the times can be decided well before they even step into the octagon.
Definitely. And we'll look at the weigh-ins to tell the tale. On to our next fight, another rematch and another one from years ago. Pedro Munhoz coming in against Jimmy Rivera. And this one, they size up extremely well. Actually, it's extremely interesting how they size up, because Munhoz is going to carry the 2-inch height advantage, but Jimmy Rivera has got a 4-inch reach advantage. And this is a guy that's a high-level boxer, extremely good counters.
Jimmy Rivera is bigger than nobody.
Yeah, one of the smallest guys out there, especially at 135. You know, he's just beefy. And does he have a neck? I don't know.
He's still looking for it.
Speaking of necks, he's actually coming off of some neck injuries and finally feeling better. you know, he had a great win over, you know, Cody Stamann recently. And, you know, while he did lose that fight to Peter Yan, he gave him a hell of a run for his money. And if he hadn't gotten knocked down at the end of two different rounds, I think Jimmy Rivera walks away with that fight.
Yeah, it's certainly a possibility. It certainly makes it a lot closer. You know, when you get knockdowns, it's really hard to win.
Jimmy Rivera, only 4 losses in his career. Pedro Munhoz, only 5 losses in his career. But you take a look at the names that Rivera lost to: Peter Yan, Aljamain Sterling, Marlon Moraes, you know, and his other loss to Bermudez by, you know, on the Ultimate Fighter back in 2011. You know, Munhoz just lost to Frankie Edgar. You know, he also lost to Aljamain Sterling, but then Dodson, also a split decision, which Edgar also was. Then another split decision, which he lost to Jimmy Rivera, and a unanimous decision to Rafael dos Anjos. So I don't think that his losses are as impressive as Rivera's losses, if that makes any sense to you. And we saw these guys fight before. So the thing that just sticks out to me, you got the crisper counter puncher. Rivera can match the leg kicks. And I don't think either of these guys are going to knock each other out. Although we saw a little flash knockdown on either side. I think it was round 2 in their first matchup. But at this stage of their careers, I'm not seeing either guy knock each other out. While it's certainly possible, I'd be willing to say that this fight should definitely go to the decision. And, you know, I don't feel good enough to just bet Rivera that way. Just that flash knockout just sticks in my mind. So I'm going to stick at the money line here, minus 152 on DraftKings, minus 148 on FanDuel. That's short enough for me to play it.
Sure. Yeah, I agree with you. I'm on Rivera here as well. Rivera is an incredible wrestler with good boxing, high striking defense, great takedown defense, good boxing and clinch work. The big problem I have with Rivera is the most strikes he's thrown in a fight was against Munoz the first time. And since then, he's has not matched that output. Whereas Munoz is somebody that has, you know, consistently will throw, you know, 100 punches or land 100 punches. So that does make it a little is different. Sorry. That can make it a bit difficult to predict. That being said, I do think that this fight stays standing because nobody can take down Jimmy Rivera. So while Pedro does have the superior advantage on the jiu-jitsu, I don't think he's going to get a chance to use that. So when this fight stays a kickboxing match, or at least in the boxing range, I certainly like Rivera as the better striker.
Pretty simple. Like in the earlier matchup, it's a rematch. So a lot of times those, you know, the winners the first match are going to win the next time about 2-1.
So my favorite bet probably of the entire card, if I'm just being completely honest, is Jimmy Rivera by decision plus 110. Jimmy Rivera constantly goes to decision. He's one of those Bilal Muhammad types that is just constantly working for that decision. That's what I like. I have a little juice head parlay, if you could guess who that's going to be with. I have Jimmy Rivera parlayed with Alexander Hernandez, the little tiny juice boys. Nice and jacked up. You parlay those little boys together at plus 150. If you're feeling extremely saucy and crazy, you can parlay them both to win by decision together at plus 393. Just a little spring.
I never heard anybody.
But I really like Jimmy Rivera here. I see this very similarly to the Dariush and Diego Fajera matchup, in the fact that both guys have, while they've gotten better, the bones of their matchup and the bones of who they are as the fighter is the exact same. So the way that the fight is going to play out is the exact same. Like, Dariush won that fight with, you know, pressure and wrestling and all the same things that he won the first fight with. And I see the same thing here happening for Jimmy Rivera. So give me Jimmy Rivera by decision.
Now we have Montana De La Rosa and Mayra Bueno Silva. This should be a great matchup in our a featured event on the main card. You know, Silva is 7-1 in her career versus De La Rosa, who's 11-6. 9 submissions for De La Rosa, and Silva has 5 herself. You know, classically, when we see two high-level grapplers come against each other, it plays out on the feet. I could definitely see good striking matchup here. And on paper, De La Rosa looks to be an inch taller, 1.5-inch reach advantage. And I'm very interested to see at weigh-ins, you know, De La Rosa actually younger by a few years, even though she has 4 more fights than Silva in the UFC. So if they come in, they face off and De La Rosa looks a little bit bigger. You know, Silva's given up some control time in the past. Even if we think it could stay on the feet, if there's a clear path to victory, you know, just controlling from the top and avoiding submissions, you know, De La Rosa's only lost by 1 submission in her career to Mackenzie Dern. And
Buena Silva is somebody that's, you know, like kind of looks a little soft in the body. So I'm certainly interested to see how she comes in at weigh-ins. I want to see how she looks standing next to Montana De La Rosa. If Silva, for some reason, looks like seriously thicker or seriously bigger, it might really cause me some pause. Montana De La Rosa, very similar to Kevin Kroom, really seemingly the public dog. So that always gives me a little bit of pause. When you look at Silva's fights, you know, her 1 loss to Moroz obviously was not a good look for her. I think Moroz is you know, a really good up and coming fighter. So it's kind of hard to rub her for that one. Jillian, her sub win versus Jillian Robertson is probably her best win of her career, her very short career at 7-1 at this point. You know, obviously Montana De La Rosa coming off that unanimous decision loss to Vivian Araújo. I think a lot of people that like De La Rosa are kind of hanging their hat on how good she looked in that third round versus Araújo, hanging tough and hanging in there and landing strikes and her improved striking. But that being said, she has this nose issue. She's had surgery on her nose. Her nose continues to bleed and have issues. She's had problems breathing in fights. I would really look to see that her nose is not could be a possible issue again in this fight. She's just not somebody that's very consistent. So it is very difficult for me to pick her. At the same time, again, at what point do we start fading Team Elevation fighters? Right, I don't want to be like rude or anything, but right, we watched Justin Gaethje lose. We watched Curtis Blaydes lose. We've watched a lot of these guys over at Team Elevation lose, and that might sound a little square. Obviously, they're fighting the highest level. We can continue to look at that gym. They're obviously one of the up and coming gyms right now, but I think at the moment, you know, when they were on a little bit of a hot streak, I think right now they're on a little bit of a cold streak.
Forgetting about Kamaru Usman? Are you forgetting about Corey Sandhagen? Yeah, I guess I don't know, man. I get what you're saying, but they produce high level fighters, and they have a stable absolutely. of women to really be able to work your game against.
Well, that Shannon Dobson who lost.
Yeah, and they also got JJ Aldridge. Like, they have a few other fighters there.
Who has she actually just got booked? JJ Aldridge who
today? Yeah, yeah, no, good
right.
Stuff.
Well, good for her. But
I think that, you know, Bueno Silva is someone that's going to have a little bit more explosiveness. She's got some good spinning attacks, and she does throw those low kicks well. And, you know, De La Rosa also, you know, heavy on that lead leg and gets caught with those low kicks. But as you see in round two and round three against Araújo, she really starts landing these nice counters. And, you know, if she's going to have a little bit more of a reach advantage here, I don't think Silva is as explosive as Araújo on the feet, even though she might be a little more explosive than De La Rosa. I was still able to see De La Rosa landing some nice clean counters. And, you know, like I said, if we get to some control time here, that could also sway the judges. It's definitely interesting at plus money, but for the most part, I might just stay away from a bet on this fight.
It's just so dangerous. When you look at Montana De La Rosa, her three wins, her big wins are Christina Marks, not in the UFC. Rachel Ostovich, not in the UFC. Nadia Kasem, not in the UFC. Then she has a unanimous decision win against Mirara Barella, not in the UFC. And that's a girl that Silva submitted in the first round. So I don't want to play like simple MMA Wikipedia math, but like one person beats somebody by decision, one person subs them in the first round. It's tough. You know, you sub Jillian Robertson. That to me is something. Okay, now you're showing me something, because Jillian Robertson is a jiu-jitsu person. So you're going to go into the jiu-jitsu waters with Jillian Robertson and come out with a sub win. That is actually tangibly showing me something. Montana De La Rosa, a good third round versus Vivian Araújo, and unanimous decision win over Mara Barella, and finish win over Raistel Ostrovic, doesn't tell me much of anything about where she is in her career. She needs this win. She needs this win.
I'll say she probably has a little bit more of a wrestling background overall, I'd say, because I just don't see enough urgency from Silva to get up and get out of there if she does get put in that bad position. So that's a big if. It's going to be difficult to end up on a side. The weigh-ins are going to tell a big story for me, because if De La Rosa comes in not only taller, but also, you know, looking a little bit bigger, you know, I do think that this actually might end up being a grappling affair, and it'll be interesting to see if Silva can land that armbar that she's always landed.
And don't get me wrong, Silva is somebody that could like go out there like Caitlin Vieira and literally just throw no strikes. I mean, that's the other thing. The problem with Silva is that she's so low output. Like I don't really feel comfortable putting my money on her either. Montana will at least, you know, really, she'll throw 200 strikes. I mean, she'll miss 70% of them, 80% of them, but she'll at least go out there and put out some energy. Silva can be a low energy fighter at times.
Well, let's get right along to our co-main event of the evening.
Tough fights ahead. Oh my God, tough fights to predict ahead. Exciting fights to, wow, these are tough fights and exciting fights.
Nikita
wow.
Krylov versus Magomed Ankalaev. Two big hitters in the light heavyweight division. Similar in age, both coming in at 28, where Krylov has an 8-5 record in the UFC. Ankalaev is 5-1. And if we could talk about that one loss from Ankalaev, it was very sad. He comes in, unbeaten record into the UFC, 8-0, and absolutely demolishes Paul Craig for the 14 minutes and 40 seconds. And then slowly you see Craig start going for that desperation move. And he's up against the fence, and you hear the clapper for the 10 seconds. He throws up his legs. He gets this insanely tight triangle on Ankalaev, and he taps out within like 3 or 4 seconds. And then next thing you know, you hear the bell go, but it's too late. He already tapped. So that was slightly concerning as far as how quick the tap came and a lack of awareness. But I am willing to chalk it a little bit up to making his UFC debut as an 8-0 fighter. You know, a lot of pressure comes from being from Makhachkala and making that debut and coming in undefeated. So does he make a similar mistake here against the big underdog at plus 275, Nikita Krylov?
It's certainly possible. I understand where the love for Ankalaev is. He's shown incredible power, incredible hand speed. He's shown calm under fire. He's shown like just that total like,
he has a presence.
Just the ability to, yeah, the ability to just be in the spotlight, and he just shows that he really belongs. Who he's fought to get to where he is right now is exactly why the Krylov fight is absolutely perfect. Because in my mind, he has fought nobody. I mean, he's fought nobody. Knocking out Ion Cutelaba twice is awesome. Great job. But, you know, we know what Ion Cutelaba is. Dalcha Langambula, same idea, except just bigger and gasses out even quicker. Kidson Abreu, not in the UFC. Marcin Prakniau, not in the UFC anymore. So while Ankalaev has certainly shown that he, you know, has earned his ranking of number 10, right? Is he ranked number 10? What I'm saying is that Ankalaev has really earned this co-main event status. Ankalaev has earned this co-main event status, and he will have the biggest test of his entire career here against Krylov, who has fought legitimate competition, beat Johnny Walker, lost a close split decision to Glover Teixeira, choked out OSP, and loses to the current champ, Jan Błachowicz. His record is, you know, a little salty in that respect, 27-7, but he's fought really good people. And I find it really tough to lay my money on Ankalaev and all that chalk.
So the angle I'm looking at for this fight is Krylov, as much as I'm attracted to the plus 275, my pick on who's winning this fight is Ankalaev. I said it earlier in the week, but I just think his hand speed is elite. He's going to be able to counter. He does keep his hands a little low. I'm always looking at that. So those head kicks from Krylov could present a problem, but we've seen his chin stand up throughout his career. So we saw him get a round 4 knockout of Grishin. So he's shown that he can carry his power late. He got a round 3 knockout of Lunjambula after surviving some grappling exchanges with the judo black belt and really powerful fighter. I saw Ankalaev pull off this crazy reversal where Craig went to take him down and from his knees, on two knees, picks up Craig and with a double leg and slams him down. And it just showed off just a complete awareness of his body and ability to make things happen on the ground. So where Krylov has shown extreme survival and ability to really put on the pressure offensively grappling as he did to Johnny Walker in his last fight, I don't think that Ankalaev is going to gas out like St. Prude did. And it's not like Krylov can throw up a triangle choke. You know, he's more of an arm triangle choke kind of guy. You know, he doesn't really have that flexibility to lock in that type of choke from the bottom. He's relying on jumping guillotine.
If Krylov can make this a dirty fight, if he can really grind and wear on Ankalaev, I don't know that Ankalaev has the gas. I don't know that Ankalaev can do it. You know, you saw him get taken down by Paul Craig, and yeah, while it was 2 of 7, that's pretty much what Paul Craig's career takedown average is. So if you give up 2 takedowns to Paul Craig, even though you may reverse the position or whatever, you've still given up that takedown. So if you give up that takedown to somebody who can hold the position against you, you're going to have a bad time. And Krylov is somebody that could use his veteranship and his savviness and where he is in it with his training partners, who he's been training with, to really wear on Ankalaev. Ankalaev goes out there and starches Krylov, goes out there, wins some dominant decision. He's the real deal and a bag of chips.
If you're looking for a plus money play and you're not quite sold that he can finish Krylov, Ankalaev by decision plus 290. That's my play. I think Krylov can win around grappling. I'm going to have to wait. I definitely think he can. I just don't think he can maintain that type of level that it will take to get him to the mat, because Ankalaev's got good hips. So I do think Krylov can win this fight. I'm not writing him off completely. It's just I can't bet on a guy that I don't see actually winning the fight on fight night. And maybe weigh in, show me something different. I could come completely off it. Follow me for my picks on Twitter. You know, we'll see what happens when it comes to that moment. But if you're telling me I could take a guy that has won a decision in the UFC before against someone with, you know, a pretty decent chin in Klitson Abreu, you know, all those knockouts, they're flashy on the record. Ankalaev has 8 knockout wins and 5 decisions in his career. It's not like he can't go the distance. So Krylov has a tough chin, only been knocked out once. And that came a very long time ago, back in 2013 by Paleli. And, you know, that was in the third round where he gassed out. You know, Krylov, the only 2 times he's been to decision in his career were his last 2 fights.
So that's so scary. You know, so, you know, you're playing, your pick is Ankalaev by decision.
Well, the recent losses for Krylov, you know, he's 5 submission losses.
No, it's really tough. You know, I find myself possibly going Krylov money line. I find myself possibly like you going Ankalaev by decision. I like a broken record. I want to see what everybody looks like next to each other. I think the safest, I don't even know if it's not even that safe. So one thing I saw that was interesting, I'll put it that way, was a round 3 or decision for when the fight ends minus 106. Oh.
Don't have to pick a side.
Don't have to pick a side. You're essentially picking just the fight to go over
that
2 rounds.
That is a hell of a bet there. Because Ankalaev has a couple of round 3 knockouts and a round 4.
That's what you were saying as well. Mm. So, you know, you've seen that. And he has even the round 3 loss to Paul Craig. So
you have stumbled on a very interesting bet here for this co-main event.
That was the one thing that I did see that stuck out to me.
A little surprise here for me. I like that.
Yeah, I'm too busy, like, trying to pick a dog out of a hat here and, like, trying to see maybe where there's some value, trying to fade Kudalaba, try to fade Ankalaev on his lack of competition, whatever, when in reality, maybe you don't have to worry so much about handicapping this fighter, that fighter who's going to win, and maybe just hope that these 2 tough sumbitches hang in there for 10 minutes so we can cash a bet.
Yeah, that's a very interesting idea.
But again, I don't know. Dude, if I told you the fight ended in 30 seconds, would that be that surprising?
No, I mean, I think Ankalaev has a couple of traits that are just elite. And Krylov, you know, maybe one of those as well in the striking with that head kick.
But this hasn't been one of my strongest cards in terms of seeing a ton of value. So this fight definitely is one of those that has me, like, a little screwy all over the place. But, you know, trying to trust my gut in some aspects of worrying about Ankalaev's credentials. But at the same time, like you said, I mean, his hand speed and striking looks, I mean, it really could be elite. So
let's get on to the main event of the evening.
We might as well.
Jairzinho Rozenstruik versus Ciryl Gane. Rozenstruik's already taken his first career loss in MMA, where Gane coming in at 7-0. Rozenstruik very quickly 5-1 in the UFC. Every single fight of his ending by knockout. In fact, only one of his fights in his career has ever gone to decision in MMA. You might be interested to hear me think that this fight actually might take a little bit before it ends. We see a couple of good counter strikers and a couple of guys that are willing to read their opponent before they make a move. Gane might come out with a little bit more output to start out. And I think, you know, he's someone that looks to establish his kicking. And he has a lot more power with his kicks than I really think he does, you know, throwing hands. And while he might have been able to knock out Dos Santos, you know, it wasn't until... And that elbow was very nice, but I just don't see Rozenstruik putting himself in that specific position. So,
no way.
You know, I think, you know, we've seen a trend here of guys being pushed by the UFC that might not be entirely ready recently. And, you know, you want to talk about, you know, some interesting, you know, resumes. You see Ciryl Gane is, you know, first, he came up through the TKO scene, which much respect to anyone who gets inside a ring, but we've seen some shady stuff and some really low level fighters come out of TKO. And especially at heavyweight, it's tough to get athletes. And for Gane, the way he dominated there, we didn't really see a lot of one-punch knockouts or anything like that. You know, three career knockouts, three submissions, and one decision now. But none of those really happened through one strike. You know, we're looking at someone that really depends on the volume, depends on wearing a guy down, and he does get people hurt. But Dantel Mays is not quite Jairzinho Rozenstruik. And
no,
I just see a plus two something. I'm thinking about last week with Derek Lewis in heavyweight, and I think we all are thinking about that. But
yeah, it's impossible not to be. It's impossible not to be. I mean, you watch Derek Lewis, who is clearly undervalued in all shapes and forms. We talked about it. We joked about it. I mean, Derek Lewis at plus 500 to win by KO. I mean, that's insane. I mean, it's just, it was so crazy to not. It was just crazy, but you don't expect that. You expect Blades to come out and dominate. So, I mean, a lot of people are expecting Gane to come out and use his grappling and use his activity and really piece up Jairzinho and win by submission eventually. Win. I don't know what people really see. I guess a submission. I guess maybe a knockout via ground and pound. Like, I don't.
Rozenstruik only one career loss by knockout to
a decision.
Ngannou, I you know that guy's a tractor trailer coming at you throwing hooks, and it's not like Rozenstruik wasn't countering him even in that exchange. Throw it through a leg kick, through two nice punches down the middle, 100%. And so to me, I see a guy that I haven't seen really face that much adversity in MMA. Someone that doesn't watch tape, which is like a red alarm to me. So someone that doesn't enjoy watching the sport, someone that doesn't, what are you thinking?
And mind you, somebody that has fought small heavyweights, Tanner Boser, small, Dantel Mays. Yeah. Bigger guy, but no fight IQ. There's no skill level there. He's the bottom of the barrel. And even JDS, old, and a smaller heavyweight. He's not a big heavyweight. So now you're coming in against somebody that's going to go in there and tip the scales. And he's in the best shape of his life training down in South Florida right now. He looks like a tank. And he knows that you're going to come in and try to, you know, take him down, get close. You don't think Jairzinho knows what Gane's game plan is? I think it's fairly obvious. I think it's obviously more obvious what Rozenstruik's game plan is. But that being said, good luck trying to stop it for 25 minutes. You saw Overeem, a 50-fight veteran, do everything he could to avoid eating that shot. And he still got his face torn off by the end of it. Whether you think it was an early stoppage or not, he couldn't continue if there was a next round. So his lip was missing. I won't do it. I lost last week on Blades. You know, call me bitten by the dog, you know, whatever it is. I'm taking Jairzinho this week. And I think I have to. I don't know. I don't know what else to do. I could very easily have egg on my face. Ciryl Gane could be the best heavyweight prospect right now, period. I mean, he could be the next best thing. We could be talking about Ciryl Gane like we talk about Stipe. I mean, he could be on his climb right now. He could be on a surge right now. Or like our guy MMA Lock of the Night has kind of thrown out, but I didn't hear him use it for this fight. Or it's a Bell of the Ball type situation where you see the UFC really pushing a guy in Gane and not really pushing the guy that they were once pushing in Jarzinho. And you actually get a win-win for the UFC because either guy sells for the heavyweight division. Gane, your up-and-coming prospect, or Jarzinho, your Suriname prince. I mean, he's the man. I mean, he's so awesome. He's such an awesome person. So, like, it's a win-win for the UFC. It's great matchmaking. I think the winner of this should fight Derek Lewis. I mean, lots of awesome things, but I can't bring myself to be on Ciryl Gane. It feels square.
Jarzinho Rozenstruik plus 225. You want to know how I think he wins? He returns kicks. He's a high-level kickboxer. Had over 70 fights in kickboxing before transferring over to MMA. 76-8-1 with 64 knockouts. He's been to decision plenty of times, 12 times in his kickboxing record. So he's someone that has proven to be patient, carry his power late. He's going to return the kicks that Gane throws, except Gane keeps his hands extremely low when he's throwing, and he doesn't have the power up top. JDS landed a few counter hooks at the end of round one, really seemed to wake Gane up, and he came out with a bigger sense of urgency in round two. So how do I think he's going to win? I think it's going to start off a little bit slow. We might get some staring in the mirror. I don't recommend you betting an over in this fight at all.
Yeah, listen, I've been tossing up different things. One thing I saw that was interesting was the fight to start round three, minus 134.
I don't even love it.
So if you're somebody that... You don't even love that. So that's what I'm saying. So that's really tough. That being said, I heard Matty Holt. Shout out Matty Holt. I don't know if you listen to Matt Holt. Listeners out there, Matty Holt's awesome. One of his best bets this week, he liked the under 1.5 rounds, which again is they're juicing the over 1.5 the other way. You're somebody that likes the over. I just think, how many heavyweight fights, especially main event, how many times do we have to bet the over and get burned? I mean, we bet the over in of the Volkov fight, burned. We bet the over in Curtis Blaydes, burned. I mean, I just think at a certain point, like, I mean, how likely, if they fought 10 times, how likely would it be that 10 fights go, 7.5 minutes? I don't even know that half of them go seven. Seriously, do half of them even go 7.5 minutes if they fight 10 times?
That's a great...
That's crazy. So that's crazy. So if you don't think that 50% of the time it goes 7.5 minutes, like, why aren't we betting under 1.5 at plus money and feeling good that in a heavyweight main event fight, we got plus money under 7 minutes? Because that's what heavyweight MMA is. Like, that's what they do. Sure, it could be patient and staring match. But like, how, right? Oh, what was the other fight? It was Derek Lewis and Olynyk. We bet over 1.5 and it hits right under. Like, how many fights do we got to bet the over and get burned on it? It's like, I might like the under. And it honestly kind of correlates with the way that I'm leaning in Jarzinho. And you know what? Let's be real. If you like Gane, you want it to be a damn close fight. You don't want to be gripping your ticket for 25 minutes for him to rip your face off at the last second like he did over him. What you want is Gane to come out early, get him down on the ground, and choke him out before he's all sweaty. That's what you want. Like, so I don't – this has to – like, honestly, I'm kind of talking myself into the under. Like, I honestly think the under 1.5 might even be a safer play than picking – either side.
I'm just playing plus 225 Jarzinho Rozenstruik.
That's the fun one. I'm gonna be barring some craziness on weigh-ins, which we just
heavyweight, it doesn't make me as nervous.
I'm gonna be on Jarzinho.
especially these guys are in actually good shape. We're not talking about Greg Hardy having to weigh in again because he came in a little too beefy. So let's wrap it up there. It seems like we're gonna have an extremely entertaining card this week, and I hope you're tuning in next week for the big pay per view.
I can't even believe next week's card is real. I mean the three title fights. It's so exciting, but to get there, we got to get through this one, and I'm really really excited for this card. A really sketchy card, really tough card, but it's always exciting when you got fights on. So please feel free to subscribe to our YouTube channel, throw our videos a like, please, and share them with all your friends at Chronic Combat Conversations. Follow us on Instagram at Chronic Combat Conversations, and follow us on Twitter at Chronic Combat. You can follow me on Instagram, Twitter, Verdict, and Tapology at @the_MMAGuru. And you can also find my awesome partner, TB Scouting MMA, on Instagram, Twitter, Verdict, and Tapology. Please check us out on all of our social media platforms. Give us a like, a follow, a subscribe, a retweet, a share. A little goes a long way. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, and we hope to see you next week for UFC 259.